I'd like to call a meeting to order. It's the House Environment, Energy, Natural Resources. Today we have an overview by the Department of Natural Resources. Assistant Commissioner, right? Well, we got them both there. Wow. Deputy and Assistant Commissioner. They're both there. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, why don't you introduce the new appointee to your immediate left.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. With me today is Deputy Commissioner David Shad. He's newly appointed. He'll be working with Commissioner Landwehr and myself over here at the Capitol, and I just want to take the opportunity to introduce him to you, to the committee, and here's a few comments for you.
Mr. Chairman, very
well, welcome, Deputy Commissioner. We're glad to have you on board. Please introduce yourself and your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Shad, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Natural Resources. Just a brief background. I've been with the department for about 30 years, mostly in the Fish and Wildlife Division. Most recently, I was the Director of the Fish and Wildlife Division for 5 years, and I'm very pleased and very proud that Commissioner Landwehr asked me to serve with him, and look forward to working with the committee as you work through the many issues and challenges before you. In that vein, I just like to offer up our assistance in answering any questions, addressing any issues or concerns that you might have. The work of the department touches many people's lives here in the state, and we want to be as responsive as possible and help you do your job here. In addition, Commissioner Landwehr is working very hard, and you'll meet him later on this morning, to put together his leadership team. But one of the first decisions that he did make is we've decided to retain Bob Meyer as Director of our Legislative Affairs. Bob, if you haven't met him yet, you will very soon. He's very active over here. Bob seems to be everywhere at once, and I know he'll serve the department and serve your committee very well in working through these legislative issues. With that, I'd like to introduce this chronic wasting disease topic here for you. Last Friday, we held a news conference to announce some very troubling news, and that is that we found CWD, chronic wasting disease, in our wild deer herd, and Representative McNamara joined us at that news conference. This is bad news, obviously, and we're gearing up very quickly to respond to this. If there's any good news in this, it's that we believe and we're very hopeful that we caught this early. We've had very aggressive surveillance programs in place that were intended to find this disease if it's out there. The worst possible thing would be that this disease is out there and spreading and expanding without our knowledge. And so hopefully with our surveillance, we detected this early, and that will enable us to respond more effectively. I guess the other good news is that we're as prepared as possible to respond to this. We do have a plan in place. We're in the early stages of implementing that plan. We've had the advantage of observing and learning from other states that have dealt with chronic wasting disease, including South Dakota and Wisconsin, and our response plan has been informed by their experiences, and we're in close contact with those states. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Lou Cornicelli. Lou will be heading up, we've set up an incident command structure to respond to this disease, and Dr. Cornicelli will be heading up that incident command system, and Acting Fish and Wildlife Director Ed Bogus. Ed has a wealth of experience dealing with these deer and elk diseases. He's a national expert on these things, and Ed will be working in close cooperation with Lou. So with that, Lou and Ed, come up.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, and good to see you on board. And we're glad to hear about Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Dr. Cornicelli, if you could introduce yourself and start your presentation. It's my understanding you anticipate about 15 minutes of this very, very important. Members, this is serious stuff. This is really unfortunate news in Representative Quam and Representative Drazkowski's district. It's near a very large elk farm that many of you have probably seen driving down on Highway 52. There's no elk left there. there's a few cattle inside the fence now, and it's fenced off to keep the animals out. But this is really, really tragic news for our almost half a million deer hunters, and it raises a lot of questions. And I commend the department for taking this very serious, and that's why they're here first thing this morning to do their overview. Dr. Cornicelli's handout will be given to us in black and white to follow with. It's just being photocopied right now. I believe there'll be one slide missing, but the handout will be coming shortly. Go ahead, and if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Representative McNamara, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Lou Cornicelli. I'm the Big Game Program Coordinator for the Minnesota DNR. And as Dave Shad said, I'll be leading our effort at the disease surveillance and management that we'll be doing in the near and far future. So appreciate the opportunity to be here. Like I said, I'll go fairly quickly. I'm just going to give you a chronic wasting disease update, kind of talk a little bit about the disease, what we know based on our current situation, and kind of what we're going to be doing in the short and long term. So what's CWD? I know some, most of you probably already know this, but it's a slowly progressive brain disease of deer, elk, and moose. It is specific to those three species, as best as we know. It belongs to a family of diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or prion diseases. There's several in that class. There's a human variant called CJD. There's a sheep variant called Scrapie. There's a bovine variant called BSC. But CWD is the cervid variety. It's not a virus, fungus, or a bacteria. It's actually a misshapen protein. So it's not something that I'll talk about that you can kill very easily, and it's not something we typically deal with when we're sick. We do believe the research shows there's a really significant species barrier. In other words, this disease is likely limited to deer, elk, and moose. There's no evidence that it's transmissible to either humans or cattle. There's been a lot of research done on the cattle side out west, and they've not been able to give the disease directly to bovines. And also, it's not known to be a risk to human health either, and there's a lot of information published by the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization that this is a disease specific to cervids, and it's not a human health issue that we're aware of through that best science. Neurological signs, you know, the characteristics of all TSEs, including this one, dementia, incoordination, abnormal behavior. Obviously, chronic wasting means the animal wastes away. There's no treatment, and it's always fatal. So every animal that contracts this disease eventually dies from it. No host immune response. So there's no vaccine. There's no diagnostic for live animals. That's really been proven. You don't mount an immune response. So there's no way to tell if you've been exposed or have it. It's very difficult to inactivate infectivity. There's been some research done showing animals that have been reinfected after 5 to 7 years. So it's not something that if you heat it up or cool it down that it dies. It's very difficult to make inactive. And it's spread from animal to animal, and it, like I said, it persists in the environment. It's not something that you pass on to your offspring. It's something that's picked up on the landscape through the saliva, feces, or oral route, or urine route. So just a brief timeline kind of leading up to where we are today. It was first discovered in a captive mule deer in 1967 in Colorado. From about 1981 to 2001, it was discovered off and on in various western states, Colorado, Wyoming, the Dakotas, Nebraska. In Minnesota, it was first discovered in August 2002 in a domestic elk around right in Aitken. And then in November 2002, it was found, I'm sorry, I left out, February 2002, it was found in Wisconsin, which is also important to us. But in August, it was found in Aitken. In November, we started our statewide surveillance effort. And from 2002 to 2004, we collected 28,000 samples across the state with no positives detected. We did that statistically based using defined probabilities in sampling that what was the chance of detecting the disease if it existed in 5% of the population given, or 95% chance of detecting the disease if it was 5% of the landscape. So we do a statistical sampling from our deer registration stations. And after 28,000 samples statewide, no positives detected. In the interim, we had a couple more domestic farms infected, one elk, one deer. We did surveillance around those farms and didn't find positives. It's skipping forward to January 2009. May get the month wrong, but it was discovered in a domestic elk farm near Pine Island right off Highway 52 north of Rochester. That kicked in our surveillance program that I'll talk about, and we discovered it in 2010 in a wild white-tailed deer also near Pine Island. Look, just basically looking at national distributions, again, started in the West, then discovered in Wisconsin, then finally discovered in New York, West Virginia, Virginia, and then we're the next state here in Minnesota. This map's not been updated to reflect our positive case. So it's distributed across 13 states and two Canadian provinces. I wanted to talk briefly about our statewide surveillance and the two ways we do it. The first was our statewide surveillance from 2002 to 2004. Won't dwell on it because I already talked about it. 28,000 samples collected in a statistical manner, fairly well distributed based on deer densities throughout our permit areas in the landscape. If you've been around since 2002, we've talked about this before, and you've probably seen our surveillance strategies going forward for those 3 years. Again, no positives detected. You know, oversampling around Aiken with that positive elk, oversampling in Stearns County with another positive elk, but specifically around the state. So when we got done with our statewide surveillance, we moved more into what we call risk-based surveillance. We can't go back and redo the state year after year. It's too expensive. We already determined, we were pretty confident the disease wasn't on the broader landscape. So we stepped back to a risk-based. And that's really at four levels, two primary levels, but four total. Suspect deer, those animals exhibiting CWD signs. We get those every year. Typically, they've been hit by cars, been injured some other way, but we test those for chronic wasting disease pretty routinely. Opportunistic sampling, it's sampling by chance. The animal's not symptomatic. Somebody drops a deer head off and wants it tested, or we're looking in an area, just opportunistically take samples. We don't do that many of these, but they're noted as our quasi-risk-based surveillance. The two big ones that we really focus on is a new infection found in an adjacent state. That's a measure of risk, and we've done that several times. Whenever Wisconsin pops a new positive, we go back and we resample the southeast. So that infection found in an adjacent state triggers our surveillance program. And then association with positive deer or elk farms, that's also a measure of risk. So we sample around those farms in the event that disease is found in those domestic areas, and we've done that now four times. Again, Aiken, Stearns County, Yellow Medicine County out in the southwest for deer, in a deer farm, and then Pine Island for the elk farm. So we were out looking for the disease based on our plan with risk-based surveillance. I wanted to talk about what we've done since 2002 real briefly. We've been actively looking for this disease in southeast Minnesota, principally because of the proximity to Wisconsin. From 2002 to 2008, this is before the Pine Island elk farm, we tested almost 3,500 deer for the disease. So we've got a pretty good track record of looking in the southeastern part of the state for chronic wasting disease, entirely because, 02 to 08, entirely because of proximity to Wisconsin. So we're fairly comfortable, at least as comfortable as we could be from the statistical sense, that the disease wasn't broadly distributed on the landscape up through our surveillance period. So what prompted surveillance in this area specifically? As I noted, the disease was found in Pine Island, the Pine Island Elk Run farm, around January 2009. The elk was found on slaughter surveillance. A group of Dr. Anderson's here could probably get into the details for how many. I think it was in the 170 or so range number of elk went to slaughter. As part of the BAH protocol, those animals have to be tested for the disease, and one was found positive. The herd was ultimately depopulated, and three more elk were found to be infected with the disease. So a total of four elk off the elk farm. Again, it was January. It gives us time for our harvest, hunter harvest surveillance, which is in November, because that's our deer season. So it set that into motion in 2009. We tested broadly throughout the southeast in 2009 because we didn't know what we were dealing with. Ended up getting 2,800 samples and no positives detected, so add that to the 3,500 we've already done. In 2010, since we were fairly comfortable it wasn't across the landscape, we narrowed our surveillance down to within 25 miles of the infected elk farm for the 2010 surveillance, and we collected another 524 samples and found the one positive. Looking at the distribution broadly across the southeast from Houston County all the way up through Dakota County, 3,200 samples collected. Specifically, if you can see that little orange cross is where we found the positive. We actually did a lot of surveillance around the positive elk farm, again, as our risk-based protocol. Over the past 2 years, we within 10 miles of the elk farm, we collected 407 deer. So we've done a lot of surveillance, and we found that one positive. You know, three deer taken within a mile, which is pretty close to it. We actually harvest about four deer per square mile in this permit area. So we took about what we harvest anyway. So we pretty good with in terms of distribution of samples. You know, within 5 miles, we took 142 samples. So in regards to sampling leading up to this, we're pushing 7,000 samples in the last nine deer season, 524 specifically this year and within the confines, at 25 miles. So we've got a fairly robust sample of deer. So that got us to where we are with respect to a response plan. In the short term, and some of this has already started, and feel free to interrupt me or catch me with questions at the end, we're following our plan that we've got posted on the website, and I can get to the committee if you're interested in taking a look at it. Right now, we're doing a fixed-wing aerial survey of a 10-mile area around that positive deer. The survey's half done, and that's the slide. I just got the slide last night, so I don't have it in your packet, but I'll get Amy a copy of the whole presentation at the end of this. We're doing a 10-mile aerial survey to get a sense of what we're looking at for distribution of deer, and then we'll narrow it down to likely about a 5-mile area within that positive deer with a helicopter survey to get a sense for the number of deer. So right now we're looking at what's the distribution, then next we'll look at the number. And the fixed-wing survey, we're getting kind of weathered out right now. It should have been done this afternoon. It's likely going to be done tomorrow afternoon because the plane couldn't get in the air yesterday, and it's not gotten in the air today. So the map I'm going to show you at the end is, you'll see there's no deer. The line just stops because that's where the survey stopped. What it'll do, once we get an idea of deer numbers, we're going to define a CWD management zone. And those of you who are in with the TB work, we'll draw out a map. We'll create a CWD management zone in the same manner we did with bovine TB back in 2005. So we'll basically create a management area. One of the critical pieces in this area is almost entirely private land. In our TB zone, it was a mix of public and private land. This is all private. There's a couple of small WMAs, but they're really inconsequential. Once we establish our zone, what we'll do is we'll put the deer on the map, we'll overlay the land ownership on the deer locations, and we'll start knocking on doors. So the next critical step is to really work with landowners to get permission to take additional samples so we can detect. Right now, we know that we've got a positive. We don't know what the prevalence is on the landscape. We don't know what percentage of the deer population is infected. Likely low because of our previous surveillance, but we don't know for sure. So we'll start knocking on doors to get permission to take additional samples. We can do that one of three ways. We can do landowner shooting permits, which is the immediate preference because we can do those today. If a landowner agrees to harvest deer, we give them a permit, they do it. We take samples and work on carcass distribution. We can do it by a late season deer hunt. Again, the problems with that right off the top is it's private land. We need landowner buy-in to do that. Or agency directed sharpshooting like we did in the Northwest. So there's various ways we can collect samples, and we'll be talking to landowners when we visit with them about all those options. I can't quantify the number of deer we're going to collect right now because we don't know how many deer we have. We're still in the middle of an aerial survey. Hopefully in the next week or so we'll come out with we want to collect N samples in order to determine our prevalence. But I can't tell you what that is right now simply because we don't know how many deer we're talking about, and I'll get into that with the last slide. Once we visit with the landowners over the next few weeks, we'll have a public meeting in Pine Island to discuss the issue with locals. This is a really important issue. There's a lot of interest already. We're getting a lot of calls. So we'll have at least one public meeting to go over what we know, what our response plan is going to be, and how we're going to go forward. Recall, we've only known about this for 2 weeks, so everything's kind of going very quickly. The other thing we're going to do as soon as we define our CWD zone is ban recreational feeding. The disease is spread by close contact between infected animals. One way we can limit infection is to ban recreational feeding, you know, animals putting their nose into a corn pile and they infect each other. So we'll go ahead and ban that like we did in the TB zone in the area that we'll define later. Long term, there's most certainly going to be import-export restrictions on wild deer parts, and that'll be both in-state and out-of-state. I fully expect other state, like we've done to Wisconsin, we've done in Nebraska, if you take a deer from a CWD-positive area, you can't bring brain, spinal column, that stuff into the state. Likely other states will do that to us. We'll likely do that to folks hunting in this area, although it's going to be a difficult one because so many people, you know, come down from the metro, and we're only talking a half hour from the South Metro. So we're going to have to work on that, but we'll likely ban import-export of parts from the zone. We'll develop another statistically based sampling protocol like we've done before. Surveillance in the area, again, this is long-term. Obtain samples from both within and outside the deer seasons. If we're looking at landowner shooting permits, depredation permits, early season or late season hunts, we'll obtain as many samples as we can going forward to find out where we are with respect to prevalence and distribution. We will reduce deer densities. That's the other thing we can control, feeding and deer densities. So in the short term, we'll reduce deer densities until we have some determination of what the disease looks like on the landscape. We'll certainly establish our prevalence and distribution of the disease. There's two models out there, really. One is in Wisconsin. You know, when they popped their positive in 2002, they didn't know what they were dealing with in terms of infection rate and distribution. They came to find out a couple years into surveillance the disease was more broadly distributed on the landscape. It was in Illinois. Are we dealing with that? Hopefully not. Are we dealing with a New York-type situation where they found one positive deer and after 4 years have not found another positive deer? So we don't know exactly where we sit, although we think we're more like New York than Wisconsin. We're going to work very closely with our partner NGOs, Deer Hunters Association, Bluffland Whitetails, you know, the Quality Deer Management Association, the local sportsmen's clubs. You know, we definitely need buy-in from all those groups going forward with deer reductions and samplings. And it is important to note that we've had great cooperation in the past from all of those groups. So I don't anticipate a lot of problems because we've worked very, very closely in the past with those groups. We have a long track record of disease surveillance and using those groups to help us with that. But they're going to be close partners. The last slide to get through this is the fixed-wing survey. And if you look at the black dots, those, if you look at the green, that's pretty much riparian woodlot cover. If you look at the black dots, that's where deer have been seen. If you notice, there's really no deer south of the last dot. That's because the survey's not done. This is basically, they flew through the 23rd of January. So this will fill in as they get done. But if you look at the positive deer, there's a lot of deer in the area. This is right on, is it the Zumbro River or the, I forget which river it is, Zumbro River? It's right on the Zumbro River. You know, this is classic deer habitat. We're in a deep snow condition this year. Deer are yarded up. They're limiting movement. They're in shelter belts. They're in riparian areas. They're in conifer cover. So they're really clustered right now. That's where we are with respect to the survey. They've counted so far, I think, 950 deer from an aircraft moving it Representative Bill, you're the pilot, probably 80 knots at best, about 80 knots. So they're not counting half what's out there. The helicopter will give us a more defined number of deer. But the distribution is there's a fair number of animals in proximity to the positive deer within 5 miles. We've already had some depredation calls from landowners in this area from deer, so we're going to be looking at shooting permits in the short term to get samples as we work through our protocol. But the take-home is, you know, we found out a couple weeks ago we're executing our plan. The survey will be done soon. We'll start working with landowners to define our sampling. Well, we'll define our sampling numbers and work with folks both at the local level and the public hunt level to determine where we are with respect to prevalence. And that's all I had. I did go through it rather quickly, but it looks like I went 5 minutes over, so I apologize.
Thank you, Dr. Conicelli. Doctor, I have one question. I think we're going to hear from landowners relatively quickly. How soon will they be able to contact the local DNR? And just so they don't, I don't want to get any local guys in trouble out of the chute. What actually will be the time frame here? I mean, some of them are going to look, and Sunday's supposed to be a nice day.
Representative McNamara, if there's a landowner in this, you know, within this 5 mile area, or at least certainly within a mile or two, they can certainly call the DNR office in Rochester at their convenience, and we'll start that conversation. Our hope is to you know, we've got all our GIS layers, so we'll overlay the deer locations with the land ownership map, so we'll know who owns the property where that had 60 deer on it, and we'll start knocking on their door. We'll likely approach them with a fact sheet, the information that we have, and talk about what the options are. So if there's someone who wants to help with the deer reduction effort and sampling effort now, and they're a landowner with deer on their property, we've already received a bunch of those calls. They're more than welcome to call the DNR office in Rochester. Otherwise, they'll be hearing from us likely, if not towards the end of the week, the first part of next week. We're starting to roll. The thing that we're up against, you know, if we think about, we have a pretty good history with this, with disease management and surveillance. In the TB zone in the Northwest, we had a much larger window with weather. You know, we knew earlier, winter lasts longer, so we have more time. We don't have a lot of time now. You know, we find out in mid-January. We likely have until the first week in March, if we're lucky, before those deer disperse on the landscape. So we're going to be talking to people this week or next.
Thank you. Representative Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barnselli, you talked about the elk herd where they had, I think, at the end of the four positives in there.
Representative Dale, could you speak into the mic?
Yeah. You talked about the elk herd that was depopulated. I'm wondering how fast is the spread of this? You had one that you found, and then ultimately when you dispatched the entire herd, you had four, I think you said. Is that something that rapidly spreads within those animals, or do you know how fast that? So, if, for example, in your example where there were 60 deer or possibly 60 deer on a landscape, one property owner, is that something that if one of them had it, they'd all get it in a very short period, or do you know what the answer to that is?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative McNamara, please call me Lou.
Dr. Cornicelli, you attended at least 7 years of college. You deserve the title. Dr. Cornicelli.
Yes, sir. Representative Dale. It's animals that are easily infected. Once the animals start shedding prion, the other animals are easily infected. The disease has a fairly low prevalence rate. In other words, not a lot of animals are actually infected to infect other animals. The disease is very slow to grow, anywhere from 18 months to 4 years. So it's difficult to determine how quickly other animals are infected because it takes a long time for the infected animal to actually start shedding prion and then become symptomatic of the disease. A lot of it is dependent on what that animal does on the landscape. You know, the average home range of a female deer is about a mile square. They move, you know, and they've certainly moved this year given the weather. So how long has that specific animal been shedding prion in the environment? Was that prion picked up naturally, which is more difficult because of the dispersion of deer, or more easily over a corn trough? You know, we don't know that. So it's a difficult question to quantify, but likely low rates. But once an infective animal puts its nose into another infected animal, that other animal's infected. So
Representative Deal.
Okay, and then thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then I'm thinking about the cost. This will come out of the Game and Fish Fund, all the aerial detection and all the extra flights and the work that you do, and I applaud you for that. But what kind of impact would something this serious have on the Game and Fish Fund as we move forward?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative McNamara, Representative Dale. There's a Servant Health account that we'll use in the short term for the first part of this. I think it's 50 cents. And 50 cents from every deer license goes in with a Servant Health account, and we'll be managing that account in the short term for this. So it shouldn't dip into general Game and Fish Fund dollars in the short term, but I'll let Director Bogus address the, you know, if there's anything more than that.
Director Bogus, if you could introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Ed Bogus, Acting Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. And Representative Dill, we're fortunate that we have the Servant Health account that Dr. Cornicelli mentioned. The short term we've got covered, but we are, with all the TB work that we've been doing plus CWD surveillance that we've been doing, we've been spending more annually than what the revenue is into that account. So the balance in that account is dwindling. It'll get us by certainly this winter, but Considering that this committee deals with policy and finance, I think we'll probably be having more discussions about the finance side.
Director Boggess, just to follow up to Representative Deal, how much money do the Serve at A Farms contribute to that fund?
Mr. Chair, the Serve at A Farms are considered livestock and do not contribute.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Dr. Cunicelli. It looks to me as if Oxbow is very close to the 5 mile. Is it in? You know, the Oxbow Park where they do have animals and quite a bit of deer. Is that in the 5 mile?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I'm not sure, quite frankly. I'm familiar with the farm, and we've talked about it, but I'm not sure exactly where it sits in proximity to the infected deer.
If you could let us know, Dr.
I can certainly find out rather easily.
Representative Quam.
One last follow-up. You know, with the testing, have we confirmed that the DNA, that this is spread from the elk, or is it more close related to the Wisconsin?
Dr. Condicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, that's a great question, and unfortunately, you can't strain type the CWD prion like you can. If you look at bovine TB, we know it was the same strain in deer and cattle. We know that strain came from the southwest U.S. There's no way to strain type the CWD prion.
Representative Deal, I apologize. You had a follow-up.
Oh, that's all right, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And one last question on the banning of deer feeding. How is that embraced when a local, when a community somewhat localized finds out about CWD in their community? I'm using that kind of loosely. How do they either oppose or embrace the ban on feeding, and what difficulty do you have in enforcing it?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, our history with banning deer feeding is in the Northwest, and it was received, you know, reasonably well. I think community is a good word because, you know, deer hunting is important, and deer populations are important. The long-term viability of deer populations is important. So this is a community issue, so that's a good word. I would suspect that once folks come to recognize that the prion is going to be spread by nose-to-nose contact and feeding may be a source of that contamination, it'll be fairly well received. I mean, you know, deer generally don't need to be fed anyway. It certainly makes it easier for them, and it makes us feel good about it. But I think once, you know, the facts are laid out, we have these conversations with folks, it'll be well enough perceived that it'll be effective. It worked in the Northwest. There's a bit of a learning curve, but I think we'll be okay with that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, I have fairly good knowledge of the TB situation in Northwest Minnesota. I represent District 1A, and I do own a small piece of property right along Moose River, and we hunt there. So I would encourage the deer hunters to get on board with your processes. I do have a couple of questions. Number one, you didn't have a number of deer that you plan to test. Do you have a percentage of the population that you would plan to test?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't looked at typically percentages of populations for testing purposes. Statistically based looks on population size. Once we get a handle on what we have for deer distribution in numbers, we'll have a number of deer to sample, and that will likely represent a percentage of the population simply by, you know, by division. But at this point, I don't know if that number's 300, 500, 700. Certainly the, as I indicated before, we have a fairly small window of time because eventually winter is going to break down there and deer are going to spread out and they're going to be very difficult to access. So that the time is right in terms of deer distributions. But I'll know more by the end of this week, if not early next week, what that number will be. And certainly it'll be a percentage too.
Representative Fabian.
Right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other follow-up, and again, this is just kind of a general thing for the deer hunters out there to get on board with this. Sharp shooting is very expensive. We've witnessed that up there, and I would encourage them to get involved in the program as much as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My questions have pretty much been answered, but I just thought of one other one here. As you go in to depopulate the deer herd and take samples, is the meat safe to eat, Doctor?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative McNamara, Representative Anderson, the best science says this is not a food safety test. It's not, you know, the prion has been found in muscle, but not at high levels. There's a pretty significant species barrier to inhibit disease transfer. So what we will likely do is either release carcasses and then notify people, or hold carcasses and then release them. But our plan is definitely not to waste perfectly good deer carcasses. Certainly, we'll try and turn the testing around as quickly as we can, and hold or educate and inform as carcasses are released. But the turnaround is generally 2 to 3 weeks. The lab may go a little bit faster if they gear up for it and they're just doing that. But it does still take some time. So we're gonna work that out this week, but we'll definitely release as many carcasses as we can for consumption, because there's no reason not to.
Dr. Cornicelli, if I could follow up, so if and when you issue landowner permits, many of these landowners are used to processing their own deer. They, for the most part, most of them will be able to be processed by them. And then, do you generally, would it be your recommendation that they wait a couple weeks for the test to come back? I know there's no connection, but hasn't the department historically recommended people not consume deer that have tested positive for CWD or Cervidae?
Mr. Chair, correct. Certainly, the guidelines are not to consume an animal that's got CWD or is sick from anything. So, yeah, that would likely be our recommendation. So we'll have a fact sheet. We'll have some processing guidelines, which we already have on our website, for keeping brain and spinal tissue out of the processing, and then we'll likely give folks the information if they want to hold them for a couple weeks. That shouldn't be that big of a barrier, especially given the weather and how long it takes to get a deer processed and such. So I suspect there'll be some holding of carcasses till results come back.
Thank you, Dr. Cornicelli. Just mostly for probably Assistant Commissioner Meyer, I think we're going to be on this for probably 15, 20 minutes more, just to let you know, and I don't know what your timing is, but this is extremely important, and I don't want to cut any members off, because this is important to the public and everybody. With that, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Cornicelli, I appreciate your sound science approach to this, and the statistics in your hypothesis for testing. A question regarding what's the statistical reliability of the test itself?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm not a veterinarian. I can certainly analyze your data, but I'm not a veterinarian. The reliability is very good. Rarely, if ever, are negatives, not detected. There's several tests they use, several screening tests and confirmation tests. So likely an animal that is positive is detected as positive. I'm not aware of any significant issues of positives slipping through or negatives falsely accused of being positive. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, could I just,
Mr. Boggess,
follow up on that briefly? Is that for the record for the committee, we got an initial test almost just about 2 weeks ago that indicated a likely positive. My understanding, that initial test is about 99% accurate. That was done at the vet diagnostic lab at the university. That was followed up by what they call the gold standard test, which has a much higher reliability than that. That also last Thursday we learned was positive. This isn't an official positive until the National Veterinary Services Laboratory in Ames, Iowa declares it official. The sample is there right now. We're expecting to hear from them today or tomorrow that it's official. But at that point, there's no doubt, basically.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Cornicelli, you talked about landowner participation and relying on landowner permits, and that appears to be a voluntary approach, and so there could be folks that don't participate. And it appears, looking at the map that was up before, there's probably some municipal boundaries in there where there may not be hunting. So what's part of the response plan if you do not get landowner participation, if you get refusal for taking deer within private property or public property? What are the steps that you need to do if the deer then use those properties as refuge?
Dr. Cornicelli or Director Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, DNR right now has no authority to enter onto private land to take deer if the landowner doesn't agree to have that done. There's, our enforcement staff do have some ability to do that sort of thing for enforcing laws, but we don't for managing deer. Up in the TB zone where we've had more experience with this, we did have, as Dr. Cornicelli mentioned, we had a lot of public land interspersed with private land, but we also had good cooperation from private landowners. And with the combination of where we had public land or cooperating landowners, the feeding ban, which was rigorously enforced, and it's pretty easy to spot feeders at this time of the year because there's the wagon wheel trails, spokes trails coming into the feeders of the deer. We were able to get enough cooperation and enough public land areas there that we could bring the deer into where we needed to get the deer that we needed to remove. We're still hopeful that we can do that in this situation, that if there's a non-cooperator, we're certainly going to prohibit them and enforce that from feeding, and we will bait deer if necessary into other areas to get the deer that we need to get. But we don't have authority to enter onto private land without the landowner's authorization for this purpose.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to follow up on the public or municipal boundary, is any of the zone within the municipal boundaries of a city where there's no hunting?
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I'm not familiar with the whole boundary or what we're going to finally describe as the CWD management zone, but certainly we have the city of Pine Island that's likely to be within whatever zone we create. We have worked with cities on hunting programs, including some in the metro area here. Oftentimes that's more bow hunting and things like that. But so we would try to work with any of those municipalities to address whatever the public safety issues surrounding hunting were. But if there are deer there, we'd try to figure out a way to get at those deer.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe the metro bow hunters or some type of the tools that you have in the metro area, this is relatively close. So there could be some options there working with the municipalities.
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yes. And we've had some more programs in Red Wing and New Ulm with bow hunters. So we could certainly use something like that in this area. I'm sure we'd get a lot of volunteers.
Thank you. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, as you've gone through this problem for Minnesota, share with us, if you would, any lessons that DNR has learned about how you might prevent this similar kind of thing from happening in the future with another kind of disease or invasive that obviously has come from some other state.
Dr. Cornicelli?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, one of the things we do, you know, if you think about, you know, diseases that are imported, however they're imported, whether naturally from walking across from another state, you know, or unnaturally in a truck, for lack of a better term, we certainly have a difficult time controlling natural movements. You know, we know that deer move back and forth from all of our border states routinely. We can't really control that very effectively. We can control environmental impacts in so much as banning importation of infected parts. You know, that's one way to perhaps control the disease. Dr. Anderson with the board is here. He can speak to how, you know, the work they've done, you know, on the farm service side about reducing contact between deer and elk farms or importing the disease in farm stock. But our principal response for disease management, you know, is to try and keep it from a wild population. And there's only so much we can do logistically. A lot of it is, like I said, banning parts if that's a key component.
Representative Wiginius.
I'm thinking not how much as you manage it when it gets here, mm-hmm. but how do you keep it out, a similar thing from keeping it out. would we have been better off if we just said no elk from these states, a certain group of states where we knew that there was disease, or even a certain group of states with an even larger parameter?
Representative Wagenius, I think you raise a great question. Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I'd have to let Dr. Anderson address that, because the board regulates the import of domestic cervids from states. I believe they're banned from importation from places that have CWD, but I'm probably not the most qualified individual to speak to importation of farm cervids.
Thank you, Dr. Cornicelli. Dr. Anderson, we're going to ask you to come. Is he in the audience? Dr. Anderson, if you could come down. As you're coming down, if you could address Representative Wagenius's, I'm going to narrow in the discussion a little bit about CWD, but currently we allow importation of farm cervid from where, and what will this current situation do to the export of those animals, and does it matter if they're close by or far away within the state?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Paul Anderson. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Animal Health. I am a veterinarian, and I've worked with the Farm Survey Program since 2002. To answer your specific question, we're very restrictive about where deer or elk can come from other states, and I'll use Wisconsin as an example. We do not allow deer or elk to come from most of southern Wisconsin. We take the areas where we know that there has been CWD found. We buffer that with an extra county. So we're very careful about taking animals. And since 2002, we've not allowed deer or elk to enter Minnesota from that part of Wisconsin. We also have bans for Colorado, Wyoming, parts of South Dakota, Kansas, and et cetera. So we're very aware of where these animals have been found positive, and we're very careful not to allow that importation to take place.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Dr. Anderson, something went wrong. So are you reassessing that maybe a buffer of one county is not sufficient? The cost of making a mistake here, I think Representative Dill is got his hands around a huge cost factor here, and so the cost of making a mistake is appears to be quite large.
Representative Wagenius, that cost is not only measured in dollars. When you start talking about people's deer hunting, Dr. Anderson, this is serious business.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is serious, and we take it at the Board of Animal Health very seriously. We're not aware that we've ever allowed the importation of positive animals. This elk herd near Rochester was found to have positive animals in it, but there were no imports that came into that herd for probably 10 years. So we're not aware that there was a mistake made, or that there were animals allowed to come in that were infected. We're certainly not aware of that happening.
Dr. Anderson, if I can have a quick follow-up, Representative Wagenius, excuse me. This disease, if you could, or if Dr. Cornicelli, excuse me, could address the thought about it staying in the soil, is there any possibility this disease was in the soil inside the perimeter of that fenced-in farm and was there actually before these elk came, and it came there from the soil and not from an importation of an elk decades ago?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the best science we have is that if the prion is in the soil, it came from an infected animal at some point. It's not a prion that's in the soil naturally. Okay. Now, this particular elk farm near Rochester was established in the early 90s, long before there were as rigid a controls as we have today. In elk populations, even in Colorado where elk are infected with chronic wasting disease, the prevalence in those populations is very, very low. It's quite difficult, actually, to infect an elk with chronic wasting disease. In Colorado, the population is less than 1% infected. So there's a possibility that this particular elk herd could have been infected for some period of time before it was actually detected.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick follow-ups. One, if prions can be in soil, could they be in food? Are you watching that? But my bigger question was lessons learned for other diseases that could infect deer or any of the other kinds of things that could be pheasants, any of the other kinds of things that are in Minnesota. Do we have a good enough strategy for prevention? So there are two questions, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, from the Board of Animal Health's perspective, we work with livestock, and we depend on our friends at the Department of Natural Resources to work with the wildlife issues. But let me assure you that we're very careful, and we take this very seriously, this chronic wasting disease business, and we're very, very careful about what is allowed to come into the state. And we have been very careful since the laws were originally put in place in 2003.
Did you answer them both, Representative Wagenius? No. Would you repeat the question again, Representative Wagenius?
I actually had two questions. One, thank you, Mr. Chair, was if something could be in the soil, then I can assume it could also be in feed, because there's lots of these things, a little soil gets mixed in with the feed. So is that something that you all are checking? That was one question. But beyond this particular disease, I am thinking about other potential diseases. Do we have a good prevention plan in Minnesota? That's for all of the kinds of...
Dr. Anderson, if you could answer that quickly, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the Board of Animal Health has very active programs for tuberculosis, for chronic wasting disease, but there are certainly other diseases that animals have that there are no programs to prevent all diseases. And, there are many, many, many diseases that animals have that we certainly don't have programs to prevent. As far as the prion being in feed or in the soil, if an animal salivates and has this disease and sheds the prion, it certainly could be in feed. It could be in the soil. We know that it can survive there for some time. But to detect the disease, we really need to find it in the animal.
Representative Hansen, to this point, was it?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think with the experience with BSE, in England, there were prohibitions on the use of animal byproducts in the feed, preventing putting animal parts in the feed. Or is that the case where captive cervidae, is there a prohibition on animal byproducts in the feed provided to farm cervidae?
Dr. Anderson.
There are prohibitions on using ruminant, which includes cattle and deer and elk and sheep. There are prohibitions on using that material for animal feed.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Members, we're going to take, I've got four more members with questions. We're going to take those and then move into the DNR overview. If you have further questions, feel free to follow up with either Dr. Anderson or Dr. Cornicelli. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Cornicelli. Did I miss it, or do we know how long these prions can live in the soil? And then another part of the question would be related to the testing. I did notice that we began testing in 2002. I'm curious if we had done any testing prior to that, and if there was an extent to which maybe these discoveries could be a function of the intensity of testing rather than something that may have been introduced in a new way.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. To the first question, I can't remember the first question. Sorry.
How long do they live in the soil?
What's that?
How long do they live
in the soil? Oh, soil, that's right. I'm sorry. Years to possibly decades. There's some long-term studies that are out there, but since we've only really been working on this disease for a relatively short period of time, it's hard to go back to decades. There's been some work done in Colorado where they've taken deer out of an infected pasture and then 5 years later put those animals back in and they got the disease. So it's likely on the order of many years, to, if not longer, because it's a very difficult disease to kill. So it probably persists for a long period of time. Specific to prior surveillance to 2002, it was probably measured in the dozens because we had heard about the disease, done some opportunistic sampling, but not really gotten into CWD surveillance because it was a Western issue, pretty much. When it was found in Wisconsin, obviously things changed, and that invoked our desire to look statewide. Was it found because of intense surveillance? Probably. You know, we've done our risk-based protocol now since 2002, but specifically up through 2010 for a reason. So it's likely was detected because of that intensive surveillance. It certainly wasn't a random surveillance effort. We were looking in a specific area based on our plan and risk. So I'm hopeful that because we've done so much surveillance over the past 9 years that we are looking at it an isolated incident. But it wasn't random. It was specifically focused on risk. Does that answer your question?
Representative Jaskowski, follow up.
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Cornicelli, so could there be other parts of the state, realizing we have done intense work in this area, that may also have a certain level of the disease prevalent, that absent the testing, we just don't know it's there?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, certainly that's a possibility. You know, we haven't gone back and resampled the state. It's expensive, you know, it's time-consuming. Our best opportunity is going to be risk-based. That's where we get the most, quote, bang for the buck. Does it exist somewhere else? You know, maybe. We haven't been, you know, we do our opportunistic and suspect surveillance, which is another good tool for finding it in the absence of looking state in the more broad sense. But there's no definitive way to say, nope, this is the only place. But I think we're comfortable, given our surveillance history and the awareness of the public to turn in deer that don't look right, for lack of a better term, that it doesn't exist across the landscape at any great level.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jaskowski, we realize how important this is and how close it is to your district.
Thank you.
Will have the latitude to ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, Dr. Cornicelli. Do we know what the long-term implications are if this disease is not contained? What do we know from other states? It maintains itself at certain background levels, I'm assuming. And what implications would that have for the deer herd?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative McNamara, Representative Jaskowski, that's an excellent question. As Dr. Anderson pointed out, the infection rates on elk are low. Unfortunately, the infection rates on deer are higher. They're more easily susceptible to the disease. There's a couple of ways to look at it. If we're indeed more like New York, we may be able to eliminate the disease. Certainly not. That doesn't mean eliminating the population, but we can eliminate a disease, you know, without dramatically affecting deer populations. I think bovine TB would be a good example. If the disease is more like Wisconsin, then we're looking at more of a containment management strategy. It's going to be on the landscape in perpetuity. The issue with this disease, you know, it's not poorly understood, but it's not entirely understood. What we do know that left unchecked, you see increasing prevalence, which would have an impact on long-term deer densities. We're not talking about, if you look at acute disease, say anthrax or blue tongue hemorrhagic disease, that rolls in, kills a bunch of animals, and it moves on. It's got a short-term effect. If you look at a disease like CWD that can have an increasing prevalence rate but is always fatal, we're talking 25, 50, 100 years down the road. We're not talking, you know, five-year impacts. We're talking generational impacts. And that's why it's important that if we're indeed on the tip of an infection, and if we can wipe that out, that infection out, then we're better positioned going forward for the next generation. So it's a long-term strategy, and I'm hopeful that our you know, intensive surveillance has indicated that we're looking at a dot, not looking at a splash.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm thinking about the actual taking of the animals by the hunter, because this is going to have a huge ripple effect, I think, in the hunter population. This may be for Mr. Bogus or Mr. Conrad. When you say that we can't export the parts, like the head and the spine and the parts that you mentioned from South Representative Drazowski's area up here to the metro, as an example, then what is the complication does that have? I would think that the next step would be quartering of the animal, and then how would that be affected by the tagging and the identification and the enforcement of our laws regarding those particular issues?
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, we would need to work with local processors, hunters, and so forth if we have a regulation like that to provide for means for people to either get the deer processed within that zone or to reduce the deer to fewer parts than they can right now legally to transport meat that does not contain brain or spinal column or things like that. So those will be significant issues that we don't have totally figured out at this time.
Thank you. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, doctors. With the viability life, are there any reagents or any way to treat? So if there are salt lick areas, there are high-density probable areas of possible contamination, are there any processes and reagents that we could use to degrade this sooner?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Qualm, no, there are not. There isn't. You can't just, for lack of a better, pour bleach on it. No. It has to be heated up, I believe, to 2,200 degrees to be inactivated. We do clean instruments with bleach when we do our surveillance. That's the best we've got, but likely it doesn't really do much.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, you've talked a little bit about deer feeding is one thing that may be an issue here. What else can the public do that might help handle this problem in the future?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think a general awareness of the disease and the implications to long-term deer populations goes a long way. Having the deer tested at a registration station, which we have a good history of that, don't dispose of the carcass on the landscape. We'll have to get into it down the road. Carcass disposal methods, and I would guess we'll be working with some other agencies on that. But if it's an infected deer, dropped on the landscape, that's a disease risk. So we're going to have to be working with the hunting public for sure with regards to sampling and carcass disposition. And again, we're still not talking about a lot of animals, and by the end of this winter, hopefully we'll know more. But just that education and awareness of risk will go a long way. And certainly the feeding part is really big, because it's not only hunters who feed. People feed for a lot of reasons, and a lot of those people don't hunt at all. They just like to see deer. So making them aware of what they're potentially doing would help quite a lot.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick follow-up, Dr. Cornicelli. You talked about feeding stations. What about food plots? I know a number of my hunter friends that have food plots. Do they have a role in this, or are they kind of on the okay side?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the key to disease transmission is nose-to-nose contact and exposure, and it's been our position. And if you look at bovine tuberculosis in Michigan, CWD in Wisconsin, there's really no evidence to suggest that a cornfield, is really a big disease risk, because those animals are spread across that food plot. I don't see us banning standing corn, because that's an agricultural practice. So it'd be a difficult one to enforce, even if you wanted to. But we don't think that a food plot or an alfalfa field or anything like that is any great disease risk. The disease risk is sharing a trough, for the simplistic answer.
Thank you, Dr. Cornicelli and Director Bogus, and we look forward to following up, and we'll keep close tabs on this issue. Next we have members, Assistant Commissioner Meyer is coming down, and I believe our new Commissioner Landwehr is in the audience. So Commissioner, if you'd come down at this time, that'd be great, and introduce yourself and let us know what you're going to be working on, and thank you for agreeing with Representative Fabian's importance of House File 1 and doing your part to move his legislation forward. It was good to meet with you about that last week, and we appreciate the support for Representative Fabian's bill. Welcome. We look forward to working with you. Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman McNamara and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here today. For the record, my name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the new Department of Natural Resources Commissioner. I've been on the job now for about 2.5 weeks, closing on rapidly on 3 weeks. I thought I'd take a couple moments just to give you a little background about myself and a little bit of my perspective on the department before I'd be delighted to answer any questions you have. I am a lifelong resident of Minnesota, a lifelong conservationist. I've worked for about 3 decades in the area of conservation. I began my career with the Department of Natural Resources about 1981, subsequently worked for Ducks Unlimited and the Nature Conservancy. I've got a master's degree in wildlife management, and unlike most wildlife biologists, I also have an MBA with a finance concentration from the University of Minnesota. I realized early on that in administration of natural resources, sometimes biology degree doesn't serve one as well as perhaps a business degree, and decided to pursue that in the early 2000s. I've also served as an elected official for the city of Shoreview as a city council member for 2 terms, and I've served on a water management organization in the metro area as well as the Citizens Advisory Council on a watershed district. I've been an active outdoors person. I enjoy hunting, fishing, canoeing, camping, and especially when I can take my 2 children, ages 13 and 11, almost 11, out camping with me as well. My daughter, as she approaches 11, has now informed me that I can no longer call her princess in public, but I can do it in private, and I still enjoy doing that. I'm honored to be selected by the governor as the next commissioner of natural resources. The department has an immense task managing the state's public resources, and I appreciate the partnership we have, especially with the legislature and the commitment and the passion you all bring to this job as well. As you all know, the economy of the state was founded on the use of natural resources, starting with fur, moving to forests and iron, and continues to be an important component of our economy throughout the state, and especially in rural parts of the state. I think it's the job of the commissioner to balance the use of these economic needs with the sustainability of those resources into the future. We have a responsibility to use our resources wisely while not impairing the ability of our future generations to also use these resources. I think the historical definition of conservation, at least as I have heard it in my work in the conservation field, is conservation means wise use. And I think that is a good thumbnail for the use of natural resources. If we use our resources wisely, like the goose and the golden egg, they will sustain our economy for a long time. If we use them unwisely, we will suffer damages for a long time to come. I look forward to working with you over the next few years. I appreciate again your commitment to natural resources by virtue of your serving on this committee. I understand we may have our disagreements, and I hope to always be able to speak with you candidly and civilly about those issues, and I look forward to an exciting session as we deal with some rather immense issues ahead of us. So, Chairman McNamara, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for our new commissioner? Commissioner, everybody's happy with you being here. They just are just tickled. They have no questions.
Chairman McNamara, I hope that trend continues into the future as well.
Yes. So, well, sorry, it just ended. Representative Anderson.
It had to end sometime, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Mr.
We didn't really mean that, but Representative Anderson, question for the commissioner.
Thanks for being here. Do you anticipate any changes in your management with the school trust lands in terms of getting more economic value out of those lands?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Chairman McNamara, Representative Anderson, I know that right now there's a very big issue with the education folks, in particular with the legislature as well, with respect to the use of the school trust lands, which, as you all know, were established to provide a base of funding for the school system in the state of Minnesota. One thing I'd point out as well, because there has been a lot of discussion about the ownership of land by the Department of Natural Resources, 2.2 million acres of that land is school trust land, so it was given to the state by the federal government as a way to provide funding for schools. A little known fact is that in 1900 we had over 8 million acres of school trust land, so we have in fact over the last 100 some years divested of a substantial portion of that school trust land. to your point, Representative Anderson, can the school trust lands be managed better? I suspect that's true. And as you know, there's been a report developed recently that is looking at some uses of school trust lands that perhaps could increase revenue to the state. One of the very imminent practical realities, of course, is that mining right now, and not just non-ferrous mining, but iron mining as well, is on the verge of a large expansion. I was in Virginia last week meeting with a number of the iron mine operators. They went around the table, about a dozen of them, and told me about their expansion plan. Virtually every operation is talking about expanding, and it's a huge expansion of our traditional iron ore mining, and not to mention the non-ferrous, which, as you know, also has some huge opportunities in the near future. So I think just the cyclical nature of minerals, and in particular iron, is going to bring a lot more to school trust lands as a result of that. But certainly we should be looking at opportunities for additional forestry, perhaps leasing of some of these lands, I think, has been thrown out as an option, and making sure that we're really maximizing the revenue from those lands, which is our charge.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I would not leave off the idea of, is it allowed by law to sell this land, if that seems to make the most sense?
Chairman McNamara and members of the committee, it is allowable to sell trust lands as long as the proceeds are deposited into the trust fund.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Landwehr, welcome.
Thank you.
The DNR has a wide range of responsibilities, and you can look around the room here and there's a wide range of stakeholders and interest groups who are very interested in their little piece of the Department of Natural Resources. And you've worked as one of those stakeholders prior to coming here, and so my question is, how do you balance sometimes some very loud voices, sometimes some very soft voices, but a variety of voices from stakeholders or special interests who want what they want, and they may represent a few thousand people versus the 5 million people of the state who you have responsibility for managing the land for?
Commissioner Landwehr, I think Representative Hansen's referring to the now dwindling 85,000 duck hunters that used to be a lot larger group. Commissioner Landwehr.
Chairman McNamara and Representative Hansen, I'm pleased to count myself still among those 85,000.
So am I, Commissioner.
To your question, Representative Hansen, I take a little pride in my ability to recognize the hat that I'm wearing at the moment in time, and as I mentioned, I served as an elected official as well, recognizing that you know, what I needed and wanted for my family wasn't necessarily what the community at Shoreview needed and wanted. And I recognize now that as a commissioner, I certainly want to listen to, need to listen to individuals and stakeholder groups. My job now is to serve all the citizens of the state in the management of natural resources, and I intend to do that, and I trust if I appear to not be doing that, I will count on my colleagues here at the legislature to advise me of that. But I do think it is sometimes challenging to figure out if you are hearing from a minority or a majority. I know from my previous time at the Department of Natural Resources that the people we tend to hear from are the 5% who are unhappy. We never hear from the 95% who are generally satisfied. And I have been guilty of that myself. If I go out and I shoot three pheasants on a December day, I have never called the DNR and said, great job on pheasant management, I just had an outstanding day. But by golly, if I go out and I hunt 2 days and I don't see a duck, I'm going to write a letter to the editor and you're going to read about that. So I think that's one of the perspectives I have to balance as well, is that and you all do as well. The people that we hear from very often are the people who are dissatisfied, and the people we don't hear from very often are the people who are satisfied. But I do believe that as long as our guiding principle is the stewardship and sustainability of our resources for the long term, I think we may not always agree with the constituency, but we will be doing our job the way we should be.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I also enjoyed our trip that we took up north, and we discussed some of these issues, and I just want to reemphasize, you know, how important some of them are to us up there with regards to HF1. You know, our businesses, you went to the canola crushing plant. I know that in the future they're going to have more permits that they're going to need to complete that project. Part of HF1 is streamlining that process, and I certainly hope that we can work together to do that. Roads and ditches are an issue up there. I got an email from one of our county commissioners, or excuse me, county engineers yesterday on that $12,000 ditch project that we talked about. The expenses are now up over $400,000 because of ongoing concerns by different groups of people. Flood mitigation for the city of Rosa. We discussed the Moose River project when we flew over that. I was able to point that out to you. We have ongoing flood mitigation issues up there, and we hope that the state and the DNR is going to be a partner in helping us to solve those long-range problems. In response to question or comments about 5 million people versus the people that live up north, my response is that we live up there. Snowmobiles and ATVs are a way of life, not just because Polaris and Arcticat manufacture those, but because we use them. And closing off and limiting access to state lands simply because people don't understand the uses of those vehicles in our world, I think is inappropriate. And then, of course, we've also discussed, land issues and so forth up there with regards to purchasing and maybe selling some small parcels. I know that's an open-ended question, but I'm just trying to bring those things forward again. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Landwehr, did you want to comment on Representative Fabian's editorializing the situation in northwestern Minnesota?
Thank you, Chairman McNamara, and thank you, Representative Fabian, as well. I enjoyed our trip. I think, one of the ironies of natural resource management, I find, is that the place where we have natural resources tends to be the place we don't have people. And I recognize that in northwest Minnesota we have an abundance of natural resources. We have not so many people. And so oftentimes the issues are different in areas like northwest Minnesota, and there certainly are abundance of them. One of the jobs of the commissioner, of course, is to balance uses and I know that some of the issues of the past with respect to motor vehicles have been a very delicate balance, in particular with ATVs and snowmobiles. I do think we've had some good resolutions to some of that in the past, at least from a statewide policy standpoint. And I just commit now to working with you and with the local units of government up in northwestern Minnesota to try and amicably resolve some of these issues. And I think we will.
Thank you, Commissioner. You're now going to hear from the other corner of the state with lots of natural resources and few people. Representative Dale.
Well, thank you, and welcome, Commissioner. I think when you shoot three pheasants in December, you need to thank Representative McNamara.
And Representative Dale, who authored the bill when it finally happened.
Because we couldn't get that done until we passed it in law. So anyway, I just had to enjoy the three pheasants. I think we all are during that period of time. I wanted to go back, Commissioner and Chair McNamara, onto the school trust land that, as you know, is not only very passionate but also critical to the schools and to the DNR because a fair amount of your budget, particularly forestry and the minerals management account, come for those particular uses from those resources. Living in the Northeast district that's over 10,000 square miles that I represent, that land is both an asset and a curse. And, some days it's one and some days it's the other. But, the northern tier was spared the development during those early 1900s, as you suggested. And I really encourage you to look at alternative ways to manage the land, and particularly during some of the things that my involvement dates back to Commissioner Alexander in the beginning. And, exchanges, consolidating holdings. We've had numerous built, but we always get log jammed. And they're like House File 1, not that every provision in House File 1 is perfect, but we need to do something that is kind of moving away from the way we've done it in the past and managing that. And with that said, I just wanted to caution, I heard the word sale two times, both from you, Commissioner, and from Representative McNamara. There are only three ways to dispose of or to deal with school trust land. One is a sale at a public auction, so that would actually be a sale. The other is a condemnation, and the other is an exchange for lands of equal value. And that's very specific. And frankly, it was specific in our Constitution to limit how we did that. And so I think really the exchange thing with our counties or with private in-holders and trying to consolidate and being a little more flexible but stay within the parameters of the Constitution is where we need to go, and we need to go there soon, because this your organization comes here every 2 years and appoints in between and makes appeals for additional money for management, and part of that management money is because of the way that we have this checkerboard pattern of land ownership, which complicates it. And I mean, we've got foresters from the U.S. Forest Service going over school trust, over ConCon lands, over tax forfeit lands, and I mean, it's just a mess. And if you would have a legacy, if you could only make 10% progress out of 100% during your term as the commissioner, and I encourage you to, I am certainly willing, and I know many other members are willing to look at this too. So thank you for the time to say that, but it's just terribly passionate and terribly important for all people of the state. I mean, frankly, if you go to Worthington, not to pick on Worthington, we'll go to Representative Drazowski's district or Representative Gunther's, and you ask them, how much money do you get from the school trust for your kids? They all look at you with glazed eyes. We got to do a better job than that.
Comments, Commissioner Landwehr?
Chairman McNamara, Representative Dell, I wholeheartedly agree. One of the things I learned years ago was that when you look at a plat map of any township in northern Minnesota, it is, as you mentioned, a checkerboard of ownership. And of course, some of that is the legacy of the way that the school trust lands were set up, two sections out of every township, but a lot of that is by tax forfeit. And there's no doubt in my mind that there are isolated 40s out there surrounded by private land that have almost no value for recreational uses for the public at large. They certainly have value for timber and as wildlands. But because they're isolated, they pose huge challenges for management. And I think that it makes a lot of sense to look at exchanges with counties to block those lands up and make ownership and management easier and more cost-effective. That's just simply one of the things we have to do with dwindling resources. I think there may be opportunities for limited sales, and I acknowledge that the legislature has a role in that as well. This is not something the department would take on its own. Just yesterday, because I do believe very strongly in this, as you do, Representative Neal, we had a senior managers meeting at the department. We have established a group in our senior managers team to essentially work county by county. It's a project that was piloted in Roseau County by Mike Carroll, our regional director in Bemidji, to work very closely with all of the local units of government, the townships as well as the county, and with the local resource people to look at the asset base of state lands, look at the asset base of county lands, and figure out how exchanges can be set up. One of the huge obstacles to this, and I know you know this, Representative Dell, is just that the statutory process for exchanges is hugely problematic. It takes forever to exchange 40 acres. But I believe what we could do is if we can work on a county-by-county basis like this with the local units of government, come to you with a whole county-wide proposal, for instance. It might say the county's got 10,000 acres, the state's got 10,000 acres. We agree that they are relatively equal in value. We want to do an exchange and do it by a bill and have it done much more expeditiously so we don't have to look on a 40-by-40 basis to do these types of transactions. If all goes well and the governor likes me, I've got 3 years, 49 weeks left, and I know that in that period of time we won't convey a whole bunch of lands, but I am optimistic, Representative Dill, that one of the legacies I could leave, is at least set in place the process for starting those consolidations and exchanges.
Thank you. To that comment, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, congratulations and thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Kind of following up on Representative Dill's questions, I guess I would just like to know maybe more broadly what your philosophy is on the ability to preserve and bring our resources into the next generations for others to use. There are some out there, maybe some of those groups that Representative Hansen talked about that we've seen a pathway that's been followed here in recent years that suggests that the only way to provide for our resources in future generations is for the government to own them. And we know that's not sustainable. We know we can't afford that. So I'm curious to hear about your philosophy in that area and whether there is room for private ownership and room within the agency to work with private folks to help them do a better job of managing their resources. That entails my question.
Commissioner.
Chairman McNamara, Representative Drazkowski. My first field job with the DNR was paid for by the pheasant stamp. It was a private lands. I was a private lands biologist. I worked with private landowners to improve their habitat for pheasants. It was recognized back in the early 1980s by the department and others that the key to wildlife populations is not public land, it is private land. Most ducks, most pheasants, most deer, most wildlife in general, in particular in the agricultural part of the state, comes from private lands. And the state lands, the federal lands, really are a trivial component provide a trivial component to the populations. So yes, absolutely, private land management is critical for wildlife populations as and other natural resources. The department, the way the state is organized, of course, the department department's charge is primarily with respect to public resources, public lands, and the, you know, and the resources in fish and wildlife, for instance. Most of our private lands work is done these days through the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the SWCDs and the great work they do, as well as through the federal government, through the Natural Resources Conservation Service. You know, absolutely the largest private lands program in the state right now is a conservation reserve program administered by NRCS. So DNR has had a relatively modest role in private lands management. I believe that if we looked comprehensively across the department as well, we would find that much of that private lands work, and I'm thinking in particular with forestry, is general funded. And as you are all deliberating the painful realities you have with the $6.2 billion deficit, I don't see that as being a role that we will likely be able to expand unless we can find alternative revenue streams for that type of work, for instance, charging for those types of services. But there's a private sector out there that can handle that right now, and I'm not convinced that the department needs to enter that fray. So I do believe that there is a private lands role. We have a number of tools that we can use in conservation natural resources. Land ownership is one of them, but easements have been a big tool of late, and we have gotten virtually all of the public resources or public benefits out of easements that we commonly try to get out of public ownership. In particular, in the large forest easements that have taken place in Representative Dill's area and others, we have acquired public access, we've acquired sustainable forest management, we've prevented subdivision and development, so we've retained those public values that we think are important without the state having to own the land, and therefore it stays in public, private ownership and generates income for private loggers, generates income for the forest products industry, and still stays on the tax rolls. So in terms of tools, we have easements, we have fee title, we have private lands work. We do a lot, obviously, with enforcement and education. There's a number of tools we can use in conservation. I think to get to the core of your question, one of the things that the department tries to provide at the behest of our stakeholders is public access. And in particular, with a large urban population, we don't, many of us still have uncles and aunts and relatives that have farms or forests that we can hunt on. And in particular, with, again, with a lot of new immigrants and new urban citizens that want to get outdoors, the way that we have historically provided access is via public lands. And I do believe that will continue to be a critical and important part of our work, again, at the behest of the constituency. This is not one of the things I try to point out to people about the acquisition of public lands. The department doesn't want to buy public. We don't want to buy lands. The citizens of the state are asking us to buy lands, and they're generally asking us that because they want access. I believe right now that demand is coming primarily from southwest Minnesota. It's primarily from the pheasant hunters that Representative Dill, Representative McNamara addressed with the expanded December hunting opportunities, and I just think it's going to continue to be important. Certainly it raises a lot of policy issues around payment in lieu of taxes and others, but I think that as long as the constituency is asking us and you to do that, I don't see that we're going to be able to step away from that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, I know you've got a number of directors in the audience that have sat through this. How do you and the commissioner want to spend the next 15 minutes?
Mr. Chair, members, if there are no more questions for Commissioner Landwehr, I would propose just taking the beginning of the presentation, the first about six or seven slides, up to the point where I can introduce all the division directors. At that point in time, I can come back whenever you're ready to do that and pick up the rest of our presentation.
Okay, that would be fine, Assistant Commissioner. I did miss one. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the Commissioner, one quick question. The report came out a couple of weeks ago that because of the sheer volume of lands that the DNR maintains, it's to some extent unable to maintain those lands. Any talk or thought about farming some of that out, privatizing some of the maintenance on lands that the DNR controls to let some gun clubs, whatever, private people do some of that maintenance for you or with you?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Chairman McNamara, Representative Anderson, absolutely. I believe that with the amount of public lands out there, the department is not the only entity that can manage those lands. Especially, a lot of my work has been in the prairies. When I look at the prairie management of prairies, much of that involves burning or cutting brush or putting up fences or taking down fences or using cattle for conservation management. I believe that that's a huge untapped resource, and it is, I think it's an important resource. I think we need to look more and more at that. I know as a result of your deliberations this year, there will be fewer state employees rather than more state employees, and we will need to figure out how we're going to manage that resource. And I do think privatizing some of those tasks is a good move, and I think it also builds a constituency around conservation that that isn't there right now.
Assistant Commissioner Meyer. So if you want to move ahead.
You
know what,
very much.
Assistant Commissioner, one moment, please, just so we don't forget. Would somebody move the minutes that are in our packet? Representative Torkelson, discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Thank you very much, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This slide has been up for a while, and I do apologize for taking down Dr. Cornicelli's slide. I thought we were ready to go, but thank you for the time talking about that important issue. Commissioner Landwehr spoke about the DNR's mission. Here's our formal mission statement: conserving and managing the state's natural resources, providing outdoor recreational opportunities, providing for commercial uses of natural resources in ways that create a sustainable quality of life. And that's really the important part of that, making sure that we can have this multiple use of our natural resources, but maintaining that sustainability. The way we look at it, and I think many of you have seen this before, the three circles that I've talked with you about: outdoor recreation, economic development, natural resources protection. We try to strive for working within the middle of these three circles. You can see the DNR there. Obviously, we get to one side of these circles at certain points in time, but when we can take all of these three critical pieces of our mission into consideration at the same time, it seems like that's when we're keeping the most of our constituents and your constituents, citizens of the state of Minnesota, happy. We are an integrated organization, and you can see we have been changing and adapting as we go on. Parks and trails have been combined in recent years. Lands and minerals, the Division of Forestry, Fish and Wildlife. Recently, the Ecological and Water Resources Divisions. That's a new division that we'll see in the budget cycle this year to help us work with those important components together at a watershed level, and our enforcement division. We have several agency goals, and this just outlines some of the high-level ones: that Minnesota's natural lands and habitats will be conserved and enhanced, our waters and watersheds will be conserved and enhanced, our fish and wildlife populations will be healthy and provide great opportunities for fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing. Minnesotans will have a high-quality and diverse outdoor recreation system that will provide for the sustainable economic use of our abundant natural resources, and will effectively and efficiently deliver services to meet its mission. There should be one at the very top of this, that we will maintain and enhance our economic engine that we do provide for the state in relation to economic growth and development from outdoor recreation, from the wise and sustainable use of our natural resources, and for providing these opportunities for people that they want so desperately. We're continually adapting and improving our processes and measuring our conservation results and moving forward. We've developed a complex performance management system that helps us to improve accountability and results. You'll be seeing this as we talk about the budget and as we talk about other opportunities there. We're measuring what we're doing, providing outcomes, and re-evaluating on a continual basis to make sure that people understand what they are getting for their dollars from the department and that the department remains relevant to our stakeholders and your constituents. So this system just outlines that we're continually planning, budgeting, measuring, and adapting, evaluating our missions and goals, looking at the trends and strategic directions, reevaluating our program objectives, and then evaluating and adapting our performance measurement targets. Over the years, we have a complex outcome and performance measurement document that you will see that we will use with you to help make the difficult decisions we need to on our budget. This current slide outlines the division's hierarchy of the organizational of the department with the commissioner's office and then the other divisions that we just recently spoke of. This is an interesting slide and one that we will talk about more in depth. We are organized in four different regions of the state with offices or headquarters in Bemidji, Grand Rapids, St. Paul, and New Ulm. But we have over 180 different business sites. You cannot hardly drive anywhere without this going through the state and identifying one or two or three or more DNR office signs. And one of the things that we make sure is that we're located where we need to be in efficient and effective manners. We talk about asset preservation and bonding dollars, but we talk about our offices, how we heat and cool them, how we drive around, how do we work with each other. The department drives the equivalent of over 2 times the circumference of the earth as an agency every year. We've reduced that by 10% the past biennium, providing substantial savings to be used for our core conservation missions rather than gas and oil changes and things like that. So we're continually looking to improve our operations. Rulemaking authority, this was done at the presentation we did in the Senate, but people wanted to, in the Senate, have an understanding of our rulemaking authority, and I think you all have a broad understanding of that. We have broad rulemaking authority under Chapter 14 for emergency rules related to fish and wildlife health. We also have specific rulemaking that is provided for in bills that you will see from time to time that give us the opportunity to amend our rules or develop rules around the statutory authorities you provide us. Chapter 14 is a very complex process, but the rulemaking process we partake in provides for more in-depth citizen input and consideration, and also utilizes the administrative law judge processes that are there to make sure that everyone is represented and has a chance to speak their voices. The DNR budget is probably the most complex that you will see within this division, and one of the most complex within state government. This slide represents the 2010-11 budgeted expenditures as a total for the biennium over $900 million. It also includes all of the dedicated funds that we've received. You'll see on the bottom left-hand side there, the Outdoor Heritage or Legacy Funds at $127 million. Now, we didn't keep all those funds for ourselves. We act as the fiscal agent for the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, or the LCCMR funds, also Clean Water Legacy Funds. We keep some of those for our programs, but we do pass through dollars on those funds as well because the legislature cannot appropriate money directly to a third party. So we spend a lot of time developing, administering, monitoring contracts and grants, pass-through dollars to a lot of different entities, and I'll be talking about that later on, but we just recently unveiled a new grant website that I'll email you that link. We have all of the grants that we provide on a county-by-county basis, a grant and aid for snowmobiles, ATVs, water rec dollars, outdoor heritage funds, LCCMR grants, federal dollars. You will be able to click on a county and see all of the grants and an update on where those dollars are, so I will make sure you get that today. But our funding is very diverse. It's talking about the dedicated funds, but we have 24.7% general fund, which is distributed not equally amongst all of our divisions, which is one of our challenges. The Division of Waters and Ecological Resources, Forestry, Parks and Trails, and Enforcement are where primarily this 24.5-25% of our general funds are located. Game and Fish Fund, 22% of our general for our operating budgets right now. $198 million paid to us by people who want to do certain things. They want to hunt. They want to fish. It also includes the federal dollars, Wallaparo and Dingell Johnson matches that are there. Natural Resources Fund, this is where the dollars from the sale of firewood at our parks or the gifts from parks, park entrance fees, all of our funds that we receive that don't go in the Game and Fish Fund are located in the Natural Resources Fund in specific areas or accounts that you can track, and we will be talking about those more in detail. Special Revenue Fund is the same way. Federal funds, we talked about those. We do receive a variety of different federal funds for different purposes. And that number goes up and down, and they're tracked over multiple bienniums, so that number is something just to keep in the back of your mind a little bit. And then I talked about the parks and trails and the LCCMR, the trust fund dollars, and the clean water legacy dollars. Our expenditures by program, you can see this is just a different way of cutting up the pie. Fish and wildlife, for example, is 24% of our budget. Parks and trails, 22%. Forestry, 18.9%. Operations support, about 9%. This is where our regional operations are housed. Also, our bureaus, management resources that takes care of all of our fleet and offices and things like that, and also the commissioner's office and all the activities we do here are in the legislature are funded out of this area. Lands and minerals, 7.5%. Enforcement, 65.3% or 7.3%. Ecological resources and water, those need to be combined now for this coming biennium, about 11%. Of that lands and minerals budget, that does include the PILT payments that come to the department and then are transferred to the Department of Revenue and spent out there, which I understand is going to be tracked in the PAX committee and not in this committee, I think. Is that correct? Thank you. I was just conferring with fiscal staff. So that's going to be a different way of looking at those dollars than we have in the past. The directors that I have sitting here, the original plan was to have each director come up and present the section. I don't think we're going to do that using our adaptive management techniques going into the future, but I did want to take the opportunity to introduce all of our division directors to you all. They will be meeting with you one-on-one, and when we do the budget proposals presentations, we will have division directors present their sections at that time. First of all, we have from Ecological and Water Resources Director Steve Hirsch. See if you can just raise your hand or stand up. We have Colonel Jim Conrad from the Enforcement Division. Ed Bogus is our Acting Director from Fish and Wildlife. David Epperly, our Director of Forestry. Marty Vadas, Director of Lands and Minerals. Cortland Nelson, our Director of Parks and Trails. And operations support, David Shad went back to the office to another meeting, I'm assuming. So he was here earlier, and you all had a chance to meet him. Mr. Chair, that is probably the best place to end. If I have any questions, I can certainly answer those, and I will work with staff to figure out when we will be continuing this presentation.
Thank you for your abbreviated presentation, Deputy Commissioner Meyer. Are there any questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, Mr. Meyer, a clarification. You mentioned the PILT payments. Are they, in fact, just pass-through dollars that come from the state's general fund and just pass through you to local units of government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes. Payment in lieu of taxes program is actually housed in two different places within state statutes. There's a payment in lieu in Chapter 477 that deals with recreational lands, and there's also a payment in lieu process in Chapter 97, which is the DNR statute. The easiest way to think of payment in lieu of taxes, it's 0.75% of the appraised value of the land that is re-examined on a five-year cycle. So this year we are in that five-year cycle. The payment in lieu of taxes for FY 12 to 17 will be calculated using current county assessor valuations on those parcels of land throughout the state. We obtain those numbers from the county assessors. We put them into a table, we run the formula, and then the Department of Revenue actually cuts the checks. It's roughly about $21 million the past biennium. I believe it's scheduled to go to about $23 million approximately over the next biennium. We're working with the Department of Revenue to make sure that they understand that they have the latest set of information. It's a little more complex than that because it breaks down by hunting lands, by park land, trust fund lands received a payment in lieu of taxes from the general fund, but the short answer is all of those dollars do come from the general fund and are distributed. And then the way that they're broken out on the county level or local government level are a little bit different based upon the type of land classification that the land is actually in as well.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Meyer. I see no other questions. We will look forward to seeing you again sometime in the near future. With that, today's meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.